This morning, how are you holding up in these twin pandemics of policing and COVID? It's time for Good Morning Nueva York. I'm your host, King Downing. We'll be here till 7 a.m. Michael G. Haskins is engineering in studio. If you're waking up now, rise and shine with us. If you're already up, stay with us. And if you're one of the many overnight or essential workers just getting home, let us tuck you in. It's a new day, new week, new decade. Get it done in 21. We opened up with Summertime by Mahalia Jackson. When that comes on, it means that we'll be talking about a diva today once again. And then, of course, our theme song, Feeling Good, by Andy Bay and the Bay Sisters. On today's program, a vivacious diva brings her powerful voice and her inspiring life story back to the stage. After the pandemic closed the show in previews, the show has now opened to acclaim. The director joins us this morning. I've seen it, and you'll be able to see it, too. In the second half of the program, there's a big fight going on in a small Midwest town. In fact, three rural counties are fighting the construction of two factory hog farms they say will do irreparable damage to their communities. A progressive news network dedicated to connecting us to movements covers the struggle. The journalist on the ground for this story is also the editor-in-chief for this network, and he joins us this morning, too, so stay with us. But first, weather in transit at 74 degrees fair, sunrise 5:47 a.m., sunset 8:17 p.m. For the day, we're looking at 81 degrees cloudy, 1% chance of rain in the morning. In the afternoon, 89 degrees partly cloudy, no chance of rain. In the evening, 80 degrees mostly clear, 3% chance of rain. For tomorrow, Tuesday, a high of 91, a low of 69, mostly sunny, 10% chance of rain. On to transit. Today, they're planned service changes on the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, A, C, D, E, F, N, and SIR. Subways are running 24/7 now. For the latest on your trip, go to mta.info. And now, on with the program.
It's a new day. Yes, it's a new life.
Yeah.
Welcome to Good Morning Nueva York. I'm your host, King Downing. We'll be here till 7 a.m. Michael G. Haskins is engineering in studio. In the background, Good Night Moon by Lori Brown Mirabal. She is the topic of our first conversation this morning. This is from her children's album, Musetta's Musical Storytime. We had her on about a year ago to talk about that. But now we're going to be bringing her subject and her story back to the show, because she has now opened her one-woman show, Charmed Life, from soul singing to opera star. It opened on July 9th, and it runs until August 1st at Urban Stages Theater. That's on 30th between 7th and 8th. Joining us is the show's director, Vincent Scott. And you should stay with us. I've seen the show. It's great. And you'll have a chance to, too, because we're going to be giving away tickets later. Not yet, but later. Good morning, Vincent. Welcome to Good Morning Nueva York.
Hi, King. How are you? It's so nice of you to let us tell our story.
Well, it's a great story, and it's a story that's had us holding our breaths all the way through pandemic, because I had her on when the show was about to go into previews, and then COVID came along, and so it had been sitting, waiting for this time. It has finally come out as a show. So tell us about Charmed Life, the soul singing to opera star.
Well, as you alluded to, so on March 14th, Lori had three previews, and then the artistic director, Francis Hill of Urban Stages, had to go and tell Lori that unfortunately, that after the third preview, that the show had to close. And she told Lori it would probably only be 2 weeks. But 16 months later, Frances and Urban Stages was able to bring her story back to the stage, and we're getting very nice reviews.
And tell us the plot line of the story.
Well, yeah, the name of the story is From Soul Singer to Opera Star. So Lori just made a wonderful journey. She started out in Nashville, Tennessee, and basically different people in her life had caused her to make some decisions. That she first thought that she would be singing, soul singing. She had the opportunity to work with many luminaries, one of which was Cab Calloway. So she started very young in college, to work with Callaway on a regional tour. And then from Cab Calloway, she worked there for about two summers. And then because of different people, particularly one of her musical teachers, John, she basically decided that because of not being offered different roles in Broadway or in regional theater, that maybe the best route for her would be to switch to opera. And by switching to opera, she was able to become a role model for many, many, many people and travel through Europe and singing different roles that were now more so available to her because of the fact that her voice was so spectacular.
And we're going to take a listen to that. We're going to listen to an excerpt of a conversation that was posted on Urban Stage's website with Urban Stage's director, Frances Hill, and Laurie. And then we're going to take a listen to her recreating part of her role in Carmen, very powerful, that was played recently as a selection of short excerpts from the history of Urban Stage's plays. So let's take a listen.
Laurie, do you remember this set and how we were on the set on March 14, 2020? And the show was magnificent. You had three previews and then bingo, we had to close it.
Yes.
And I hated telling you that you had done a beautiful job. The audience has loved you. But due to the pandemic, we are closed.
Yes, I remember that morning in your kitchen when you sat, you came into your kitchen and sat down on the lowest step. And you were so forlorn and you said, I hate to tell you, but looks like we're going to have to close your show. And yes, I remember you thinking of probably a couple of weeks. And
right.
But little did we know that the world was getting ready to go into an abyss.
That's right. And I felt so sorry for you and all the other artists all over New York and the country who had to also close, put their instruments away, put their dancing shoes away, put their scripts away, and for how long.
Mm-hmm.
But now the exciting thing is we can open.
Mettez-vous dois jazz.
This Spanish-born gypsy allowed this southern-born black daughter of a minister in the Bible Belt to tap into my sort of inner goddess, power, feminine power, and spread my wings. It takes a lot for a performer to sing this role. A great Carmen has to sing well, dance, and be a really good actress. See you.
And there you have Lori Brown Mirabal from her show Charmed Life, from soul singing to opera star. And in the show, she does a kind of mini sped up annotated version of her role in Carmen. And we're talking to Vincent Scott, the director of the show. So what does it mean to be, and I want to let folks know you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, streaming live and available on demand at WBAI.org. The program is Good Morning Nueva York. I'm your host, King Downing. We'll be here till 7 a.m. Michael G. Haskins is engineering in studio. And we're going to be opening up the lines in a moment. You can call us at 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877 on our listener line. Our listener line is sponsored by the members and buddies of WBAI. Members are people who have pledged a minimum of $25 to join the station and be part of the decision-making process and help the station move forward. Those who give more are able to get gifts from us, music, books, health products, all sorts of things. And you can go to give2wbai.org. Our listener line is also brought to you by WBAI Buddies, people who have pledged a minimum of $10 a month, automatically deducted from their accounts and put into the station's accounts to give us monthly income we can count on. Give to WBAI.org. But the listener line is now open to everyone, 212-209-2877. And we're talking with Vincent Scott, who is the director of the Urban Stages show, Charmed Life. So what does that mean to be a director? A lot of times you are sort of in the background and folks don't really know the role that you play.
Yeah, this is pretty much an exciting project because the playwright is also the player. And so my job particularly is to take something that's two-dimensional. You know, writing a play is on a piece of paper, and to make it three-dimensional. And in this case, to take Lori's life and to make it look like you're reliving that experience organically with her every night. And Lori's such a wonderful performer, but she's also just a wonderful person. So it makes it very easy. It just makes it very easy. So the director's job is to try to make your ideas seem like the player's ideas and the playwright's ideas so that you don't see their hand.
And what are the challenges where we have a one person, or in this case, a one-woman show?
Keeping everyone's interest. I just recently told Lori that it's not a one-woman show. It may be written as a one-woman show, but she's playing so many characters and she does it so seamlessly that you seem to have many, many people that are on the stage with her every night. And I, from the audience's reactions, as well as yours, King, that the evening just flies by.
One of the unusual parts of the show is the use of a portrait that, correct me if I'm wrong, she said was painted of her by her father in her outfit
exactly
of Carmen.
Correct.
Okay, so here's this great work that makes the connection, painted by her father, of her in the role of Carmen. And then you all have magically turned it into a screen where, as she's telling the story, historical photos of the family come up, pictures of roles, other great black divas, even an autographed picture to her from Cab Calloway. How did that come into play? What was the thinking behind that, and how did you execute that?
Again, it's really in connection to your last question. To have a one person on stage the whole time, there was only a few people that were able to really hold the person, the audience's interest. But to relive her life through her conversation with pictures that are in her head so that they become in your head is a way of making the audience feel like they're really part of her story. That three-dimensional picture that I myself and Lori wanted to share with the audience is a way of just sitting back, relax, and almost closing your eyes and just feeling like you are on stage with her. That's the reason why that particular trick or illusion was basically used. And just to give a little shout out to some of the people that were involved, Kim Sharp, the production, Jamie and Madeline. Jamie, as that's going, has about 140 cues with those slides, and it doesn't seem like 140. So.
No, it sure didn't, and it really flowed and opened up the dimensions. Now, we've been here talking about Lori Brown Mirabal's journey to where she is. Tell us about your journey. How did you get to the point of being a stage director and maybe other things that you do?
It's interesting. I'm hoping that your listeners will definitely come and see Lori's story. We, as black people, that African-American people, we struggle. We decide our path, but the path isn't always easy for us. And when you're following Lori's story, you then start to think about, you know what? Maybe your life was a lot more charmed than what you think it was. And so I was fortunate. I've had wonderful, loving parents, Oscar and Vincent. Oscar and Gloria Scott. And I went to Springfield College. And it just, again, through circumstances, the theater director had won a scholarship. And I was a small college and was off to Europe. And left my small college without any type of theatrical adventures. And I met a friend who then kind of said, we can put on a show. And I did. And that was in 1971. And from there, I just kept directing. I did The American Dream by Edward Albee there. And just have been fortunate enough now to have directed in Dublin, directed in London, directed in California, directed in Chicago, studied in London, in a school, Joan White English Directing School, and have been fortunate enough to work with such wonderful, I assisted directed with such wonderful people, Austin Pendleton in The Last Will, Jan Buttram in Hellman versus McCarthy, which was a wonderful experience. And then I worked with a premier director, Timothy Douglas, in Chicago. And these people really have honed my skill so that I could work with Rory and work on Trauma Life at Urban Stages.
Now, I've seen your work with the directing team at Urban Stages in Death of a Driver, which was great, and also Bars and Measures. And
yes,
we have actually had the key talent from those shows on this show as each of those came up. How did you connect to Urban Stages?
Yeah, so I was working at Abingdon Theater, and Jen Bertram was the artistic director. When she left, the people that were there, Kim Sharp and Barra Swink, basically also left. Barra, who then had a connection with Urban Stages, basically suggested to Francis that I could be a really good addition to the educational. I am a teacher, as well as Lori. Lori's a doctor. even though she's a wonderful performer, she's also a doctor of music, and she also teaches, which is another reason that Lori and I have a wonderful connection. So Barra brought me in and about 4.5 years ago, and I've been working with doing readings and assistant directing, and now I have my own project, which is on the main stage.
That's all great. We have time. We can take a last-minute call if anybody wants to dial in right now, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. So the show opened on July 9th, and it has this whole week from Wednesday through Sunday, there will be shows, including two on Saturday, a matinee and an evening show on the 31st. And we are going to, again, make tickets available to our listeners. And those of you who emailed in at the time that Lori was on, we were trying to get the schedule of the tickets arranged. And so the folks who emailed in on that day and folks who email in now will be eligible for the limited number of tickets, both from the date Lori was there and those who email us now. So you email me at king@wbai.org. king@wbai.org, and you will be eligible to win a pair of these tickets. And we hope that you'll check out the show. It's an incredible journey, Charmed Life from soul singing to opera star, and she has had contact with so many people, those that we wouldn't expect. Mentioned Cab Calloway. She had contact with Oprah Winfrey, who did things for her, and it goes on and on. It's just an amazing story to see. So, any last words from you, Vincent Scott, who is the director of Charmed Life, from soul singing to opera star?
Yeah, in a time where we are looking for hope and happiness, the two H's, hope and happiness, this show really leaves you with a feeling that you can do everything. You know, she had a quote from her mother who unfortunately at 42, the mother had five kids, the mother and the father had five kids, at 42 had passed away. And this wonderful quote really helped Lori to follow her dream. And you will leave the show ready to follow your dream. It's just so uplifting, and it's the message that Lori, as well as I, want to leave you and the audience so that you will follow your dream and be successful.
Great ending note. We have to leave it there. Vincent Scott, director of Charmed Life from soul singing to opera star, starring Lori Brown Mirabal, telling her own story at the Urban Stages Theater. And it runs through August 1st. Urban Stages is on 30th between 7th and 8th. You can go to urbanstages.org to learn more. And you can email me, king@wbai.org, to be eligible to win a pair of tickets. We'll be back with more after some messages, so stay with us.
This is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Come on, neighbors, let's get wise.
So, the plaster is falling, the paint is peeling, the plumbing is leaking, the heat and hot water keep cutting off, the elevator keeps breaking down, and the landlord won't return your calls, but the rent keeps going up and up and up.
Find out what you can do about it. Tune in to Housing Notebook, Mondays at 8 p.m.
Reactionary landlord. They stop to call for help and love. Never enough. Gave up their hope, their faith in God. No reason why to stay alive. Nobody knows what.
Listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, streaming live and available on demand at WBAI.org. The program is Good Morning Nueva York. I'm your host, King Downing. We'll be here till 7 a.m. Michael G. Haskins is engineering in studio. In the background, Factory Farms by Deadline. And in the second half of the show, right now, there's a big fight going on in small Midwestern towns. Residents of three rural counties are fighting the construction of two factory hog farms they say will do irreparable damage to their communities. A progressive news network dedicated to connecting us to movements is covering this struggle. The journalist on the ground for this story is also the editor-in-chief for this network and joins us this morning. And the program, the article that we're covering, is called The Counties in the Fight are in Wisconsin. And I believe I got that right. Oh, no, no. The exact title is A Big Fight in Small Town, Wisconsin. The Progressive Network is the Real News Network, or TRNN. And Joining us is Maximilian Alvarez, who is not only the reporter on the ground covering this story, but is also the editor-in-chief of the Real News Network. Welcome to WBAI. Good morning, Nueva York.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Where are you, by the way?
So we're based in Baltimore.
Great. Great. So I first got turned on to you all by some of your coverage of all of the policing issues, Black Lives Matter and all of that, and came for that and stayed for everything else. So before we get into TRNN and its logistics and founding, what's going on in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, what's happening in Wisconsin is sadly what's, you know, happening in states around the country. You know, I think that one of the things that we tried to really reveal with this series of special reports that the Real News has produced in partnership with the great In These Times magazine, that's why I went to Wisconsin to film this documentary that you mentioned. You know, we went there because Wisconsin traditionally has been, you know, kind of, there are sort of turf wars that happen in the factory farming industry, and Wisconsin has primarily been the state where dairy factory farms are. So primarily cows, but you also do see some other types of factory farms, including chickens. We passed a turkey factory farm at one point. And the hog factory farms, you know, have traditionally kind of been more populated throughout states like Iowa and North Carolina. Now what you're seeing, and this is the kind of subject of the story that we went to film, is the hog factory farming industry is really kind of, it has its sights set on expanding into Wisconsin. And the rural communities that we went to, including Crawford County in the southwest part of the state and Burnett and Polk counties in the northwest part of the state, you know, they're both currently embroiled in respective battles against two new proposed factory hog farms, or what are called CAFOs, which stands for Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations. But I think people know what factory farm means. CAFO is kind of just a nice acronym designed to distract us from what we're actually talking about, which is a massive factory farm that houses, you know, a large number of animals, in this case hogs, who that never leave the building, that you know, are being specifically raised to be slaughtered and you know, used in the kind of mass produced meat market, and you know, they produce a lot of waste. One of the hog farms would house over 26,000 hogs in a very, you know, environmentally rich area with a lot of waterways. And residents there are extremely worried that the millions upon millions of gallons of liquid manure that these hogs produce every year is going to cause significant environmental damage, to say nothing of the air pollution, because we know that these hog factory farms produce a significant amount of pollution. There was even one study cited in the Washington Post recently that said that air pollution from factory farms leads to 17,900 U.S. deaths per year. They're a big issue. I mean, they're massive operations. They are environmentally destructive. But also what we came to look at in this documentary was what they do to the communities there, right? I think that folks need to understand that this is kind of happening across rural America, because this is the way that the government has incentivized things to progress in rural America. You know, there's a study, you know, from the CDC itself that says, and I quote, "the current agricultural system rewards larger farms with lower costs, which results in greater profit and more incentive to increase farm size," end quote. What that essentially means is that the days of the small or independent family farm are pretty much in the past. And what has happened is that more and more of the rural landscape has been gobbled up by these big agricultural, industrial farming operations, whether those be kind of monocrop growings like soy and wheat and corn. but also these massive factory animal farms that have really kind of taken over the terrain that used to be populated by smaller independent farmers. And that's kind of what we went and saw in Wisconsin, was you have kind of what remains of these small town independent farming communities who are extremely worried about what these factory farms will not only do to their environment. They're worried about water pollution. They're worried about air pollution. They know that property values go down when you're next to a massive, smelly hog farm that's spreading manure and dead carcasses over, you know, the surrounding area. But also they're worried about what it's going to do to their local farming economies. And you know, this is something that I think we've seen in other sectors of the economy, right? We know that, for instance, like a lot of Main Street America and small stores have kind of been gobbled up by massive chains like Walmart and Amazon. Well, the same thing is happening in agriculture. And what it looks like is these massive factory farms that the government has largely incentivized, that big banks will give you big loans for. And piece by piece, it's really kind of eating away at what, you know, used to be a kind of farming industry that, you know, rested primarily on smaller independent farms. That's no longer the case. Now you have these massive operations that are owned by kind of international conglomerates, and those who used to own their farms and grow their cattle and mix their grazing are now, you know, more or less, they've either been pushed out entirely, they've retired, or they are now employees of these massive kind of industrial, agricultural, and factory farming operations. And that's happening in Wisconsin right now.
You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, streaming live and available on demand at WBAI.org. The program is Good Morning, Nueva York. I'm your host, King Downing. We'll be here till 7 a.m. Michael G. Haskins is engineering in studio, and we are talking about the fight over factory farms in Wisconsin. Three counties there. The people there are pushing back against two major factories. The series is called The Wisconsin Idea, and this is being put out by the Real News Network, TRNN. And we have joining us Maximilian Alvarez, who is not only the journalist who went out to Wisconsin and covered this story, but is also the editor-in-chief of the Real News Network. We're going to open up the phone lines. You can call in. The number is 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. And you can call with your questions or comments. Do you have any experiences with factory farms? Have you become vegan for some reason or other because of these problems? Have you ever driven by one of them? And what was your experience? The lines are open to that or any other topic you want to talk to us about. The line is brought to you by the members of WBAI, people just like you who have pledged as little as $25 to join the station and have some say in the way that it's run, but also to know that you are helping secure the news and information like this that you want that you won't get anywhere else. The listener line is also sponsored by WBAI Buddies, who pledge as little as $10 a month, automatically deducted from their accounts to ours, in order to give us guaranteed monthly income that keeps us going in a way that you want to see us continue. We're going to take a listen now to the trailer for this story, and it is part of, it is a section of a larger video that you can see. You can get all this information by going to therealnews.com, therealnews.com, and you can see Maximilian Alvarez's article, and you can also see the videotape, which includes him. Let's take a listen now.
It's hard to really, I think, sum up, you know, how I feel about all this, right? Because at this point, I'm really just trying to kind of contain my blind rage at everything that we've learned about this. And I think that that's one of the really depressing things, but urgent things that I want folks like watching this to understand, right, is everyone knows where this is going. Right? The townspeople know where it's going because they were the ones who researched.
Here we are on Harvest Lane. This is the site of the proposed growth feeder pig to CAFO, just down valley is the Kickapoo River.
This collection of effigy mounds, and you can see that these are thunderbirds, and then these are bears, and these are linear, which, but most, not all, but most of them have burials in them.
It just percolates right into the groundwater right now. And people take that up into their wells, and it goes into the river. The dynamics of how groundwater reacts, it doesn't just go down. Groundwater also rises.
They've put everything you need to know out there in public view. We know what these CAFOs do. We know what they're going to do specifically in this area because of the way the landscape is, because of how much manure we know they're going to produce. And yet, it's really just kind of a situation of who has the power to kind of ram through their version of reality right now, right? And right now, that's big ag. And people need to care about this. People need to raise their voices about this. People need to recognize that there are folks all around this community who are fighting for not just like their land, their air, and their water, but I mean their community as such. Now, you put this massive CAFO here that's going to destroy kind of all the kind of shared common resources that people here depend on. What's going to be left of the community, right? What's going to be left of the land? And that damage is going to stay for a long time. And so, you know, there's really only so much education you can get on this. After that, it's about what are you going to do?
And that was the voice of Maximilian Alvarez, who is the journalist and video producer of the story that we're talking about here, A Big Fight in Small Wisconsin over the threat of the creation of two factory hog farms there. And you end up with saying that, you know, the question is, what can people do? So first, what are the names of these companies, and is there any action that people can take to support these families? Is there a way to even avoid that meat if you are one who still eats meat?
So I appreciate the question, because, you know, I definitely want folks listening to kind of understand that, you know, whatever happens with these specific fights in Wisconsin, right, you know, the problem is much deeper, right? The problem is really this kind of massive incentive structure that's been created to essentially make the small farms go extinct and to allow these massive environmentally polluting factory farms to really kind of grow exponentially. And in the three counties that we mentioned in Wisconsin, there's Crawford County and Polk County and Burnett County in the northwest part of the state. Local residents have been, you know, really kind of trying to push the Department of Natural Resources in Wisconsin to, you know, conduct an environmental impact study on both of these respective operations. And people listening to that may be saying, well, don't they have to do that anyway? And that's where you kind of really start to see how actually the regulations on the factory farming industry are quite lax. And they've been structured in such a way that, there's very little kind of accountability for these massive factory farming operations. And people they can kind of spread the manure that they're producing and not really kind of be held accountable if there's runoff that contaminates waterways, if, you know, it does damage to neighboring farms and stuff like that. You know, once they're in there, they kind of, you know, do what they will and create a lot of damage. And so that's why residents in Crawford County, Polk County, and Burnett County are really trying to push the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to kind of step in and listen to the research that the residents themselves have done to, you know, show what these factory farms are going to mean for their communities, right? Just to give you an example, in Crawford County, you know, it's a rural county, it's a poor county, and you heard me mention in that trailer that, or you heard one of the interviewees in that trailer mention that, you know, there's a really big concern with what these this factory hog farm in Crawford County is going to do to the well water. And I think this is a crucial point that I don't want folks living in the city to miss, but when you have a poor rural community like that, in Crawford, you actually don't have like kind of this like big shared water system like we do in the cities. You have a lot of folks living on farms who have their own private wells, and they actually take a lot of pride in their wells, right? With that area of Crawford is incredibly beautiful, and it's got these ancient aquifers below ground that people use to kind of, drink. That's where they get their drinking water, right? And what everyone's worried about is that in Crawford County, you have a very specific kind of geography there where the land is essentially like kind of ancient Swiss cheese, right? You have sinkholes in the bedrock. You have these fissures in the bedrock. You have these caves, limestone caves, or sandstone caves, pardon me. And if you are spreading, you know, over 9 million gallons of liquid hog manure every year on the fields on top of that ancient kind of bedrock, then, you know, it's really only a matter of time before, you know, the increased rains in the area create runoff that drifts down to the aquifers that leads into the Kickapoo River. And once those ancient aquifers that people get their water from are contaminated, they're contaminated for good. You know, there's really, like, only so much that you can do to try to kind of get clean well water when it's been contaminated by, you know, hog manure. And we've seen kind of documented instances of this, like in places like North Carolina and Iowa, where, you know, people drinking contaminated well water, it can lead to very severe health crises, even death in infants and stuff like that. So it is a really serious problem. And the Department of Natural Resources in Wisconsin does have the ability to kind of, you know, take a closer look at what these operations would do and you know, be the one to say whether or not there should be greater environmental regulations put on them, which is what the residents are really calling for. They residents already passed a moratorium on these factory farms. They halted the construction of them for a time, but I got to tell you, King, like the folks there do feel like it's kind of an inevitability that these CAFOs are going to be put in there. They feel left behind. They feel like their state governments have really sold them down the river, and the, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency is really not kind of doing much to help them either. They feel really on their own, and I think one of the things that's really important about this
Maximilian, I'm gonna jump in. No, you're doing great. I'm gonna jump in because we have a caller. I want to make sure that caller gets heard. Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from? Your question or comment?
Nyad here. Greetings to the beloved community. A three-part, and I listen over to Ed. We need more caller feedback. First of all, how long has this plan been in place for these hog factory farms? Second, what is the size of the land? And more on the environmental study, and who are the deciders in terms of the county seat and what the process is? I'll listen over to Ed. Thank you.
Thanks, Maya. Maximilian? How long has the plan been in place? How long has the plan been in place? What's the size of the land involved, and who are the deciders?
So the two CAFOs that we're talking about in Wisconsin, these plans were proposed, I believe, 2 years ago. And like I said, there were moratoria that were passed during the pandemic that gave residents kind of time to do some research onto what, you know, the impacts of these factory farms would be. In Crawford County, you know, it's the proposed factory farm is kind of expansion of the one existing hog farm in the area, which is the Roe feeder pig. This would be a second site of the Roe feeder pig, kind of just a couple miles down the road. And then in Burnett and Polk County, it's a much bigger CAFO that has been proposed by Cumberland LLC, and actually the hogs themselves would be owned by Smithfield Foods, which is another really interesting facet to this story, is that you're going to have this 26,000 head hog farm in a very kind of environmentally sensitive area. That's going to be producing a lot of not only pollution, but it's going to be producing a lot of meat. But that meat is being sold to China. That's where the Smith Food Fields is now based. And so what
Maximilian, yes. Maximilian, we have 1 minute left. Can you tell us who is going to make the decision on this? That was Mayotte's third question. Who is going to ultimately decide whether this happens or not?
I mean, in many ways, the decisions have already been made, but I would say that right now, all kind of eyes are pointed to the Department of Natural Resources in Wisconsin.
Great.
Because local governments don't have much ability to regulate these things at all.
Great. So we're going to be following up. I'm serious. I'm going to reach back out to you to see if we can bring some of the people who were in the video on the air and get more into the action items for people to do now. So thanks for this great report. The fact that you've combined an article and a video really helps get the word out. This is Maximilian Alvarez, who is the author of both the story and the video, A Big Fight in Small Town, Wisconsin. And you can get all this at therealnews.com as well as the other great stories that they have. That wraps up our first show of the week today. We will be back tomorrow. No, we'll be back Wednesday. There'll be special programming tomorrow. We'll be back Wednesday with some more news and culture. So stay with us. Have a great day.
It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me. Feeling good, good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life.
WBAI accepts snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it. We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit WBAI.org/donate-your-car.
Dear WBAI listener, we can certainly use a little help from our friends. After years of falling behind under new management, Pacifica has now gotten its financial papers in order and can apply once again for grants. That means WBAI, which is owned by the nonprofit Pacifica Foundation, can also apply for funding. And we are looking for a pro bono grant writer to help our 61-year-old station by writing grants for us. If you have time, expertise, and interest, please contact Bertol, our station manager, at bertol@wbai.org. You'd be helping to ensure the stability and growth of this historic listener-sponsored radio station. With details, please email bertol@wbai.org. That's B-E-R-T-H-O-L-D, bertol@wbai.org, with Grant Ryder in the subject heading. Many thanks. Many, many thanks. This is listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
But alongside it, hopefully, the voice of reason. Mm-hmm.